Hello there! This show contains material which a truly free society would neither fear nor suppress. The language and concepts contained herein will not cause eternal torment in the place where the guy with the horns and pointed stick conducts his business.
Dude.
That's me.
You know what would be, like, really cool?
Fire.
If we had somebody with, like, a really deep voice do our intro with a lot of, like, reverb and echo on it.
In a world.
Like that guy.
Yeah, like that guy.
It's too bad nobody would send us anything like that.
I know. It's too bad. We don't know anyone who's got, like, a gruff, growly
gruff
kind of voice.
Personality. You know, we know plenty of people with gruff personalities.
Couple in this room.
And it's somebody else I know.
Who?
A teacher who shushed me at a movie theater. Yeah, I
stop it.
I love that.
Zip it.
Zip it.
Okay.
You know, in that last week's show where you said, well, let's reverse it. And I went, I actually cut a piece of it out and I was going to flip it.
Did you?
I didn't, though. Yeah.
Why not?
Because
that would have been what?
Because
some sort of principle?
No, it just didn't seem real since I did it manually with my voice. It didn't seem like – it just seemed like it would be, you know, contrived to add it again, a real reversal.
I thought it was perfect. It would have been perfect.
But, you know, just –
there would have been nothing more perfect.
But just, you know, so everybody knows that we have that technical ability, the next 5 seconds of me speaking and possibly John will reverse.
Right? Now, Mr.
So everything that was just before there is going to be reversed, and you're all going to be very confused.
It's amazing. I'm already confused.
Yeah. So
hey,
what?
So I've got some little news things. One thing which is kind of like a recap on my ongoing saga of copyright type stuff and internet abuses,
which we were trying to avoid on this show, but
well, there you go. The EU. Remember the EU? I think they were going to try that whole three strikes and you lose your internet connection because you're maybe possibly kind of, sort of, someone accused you of doing something wrong.
Ew.
Yeah, EU. So the EU, and I think it was introduced by Sarkozy, doing this whole three strikes and you lose your internet connection. And for people who haven't listened before, this means if you're accused three times of doing some sort of copyright violation on the internet, you can get your internet connection yanked entirely. Well, what ended up happening was a whole bunch of members of the EU.
You said member.
I don't know what they're called here. In this article, they call them MEPs. It's kind of like MPs, members of Parliament. And maybe members of European Parliament.
Then I think that's exactly what it stands for.
Yep. The MEPs, they got together and they were...
lovingly known as the MEPs.
Right. In this, not the Mets, different guys.
Who are winning right now. They were.
It says that in this article that some progressive MEPs, what they did to counter this attack...
Socialist bastards.
Pinkos. What they did is they wrote what's called the Citizens' Rights... They wrote up a set of citizens' rights, and they declared internet access as a fundamental right in Europe.
Yeah, that's interesting, because usually in this country, when we get legislation like cleaner forests and No Child Left Behind, usually it's Orwellian, and the legislation is exactly
the doublespeak,
the opposite of it. Yeah, it's exactly.
Yeah. So the bottom line is—
that one's real, though.
This one's real. You had some members of European Parliament strike this thing down.
MEPs.
And now internet access is a fundamental European right, which is, I think, awesome, because it's just like today where you have telephone is a right, so a right of communication. Well, I mean— 911 access?
I just rolled my eyes, by the way, which is why John...
Well, he's always doing that. He's got a disease.
I shrugged my shoulders. Well, you know, right? It might be going a little far.
I think in a civilized society like we're in, I feel that we should have as a fundamental right is healthcare.
And
I've spoken about this before.
That should be fundamental and first.
Yeah, well...
But they have that there, so they're moving on to the other things.
They're two steps ahead of us.
Yeah, they got the internet next, and then after that, it's going to be wine.
No, that's not a right, it's a requirement. But I think
in France, I think it is a right. Actually.
But I think people, human beings, you know, communication is something that we really, really strive for, and it's something that we need. It's kind of like air in some ways.
Well, the only reason we still do this show is for therapy, as you pointed out to me recently.
And so I think that declaring the internet access, which is one of the most modern and effective forms of communication we have today, until something new comes along. I think that it's great that it's being declared that way, because you can't have oppressive governments coming down and taking it away from you because you're being a bad guy. So now, really, the only way that you can have your internet access taken away in the EU is if there is a judicial review and there's an actual finding of wrongdoing. So that's a good thing.
That wasn't chipped before you brought it up here when you were clinking them together, yo.
I did not clink anything together.
I didn't think you were clinking.
Maybe you should take it easy with the washing of the glasses. Oh, that's right. You
didn't wash the glasses. I washed them by hand. Yeah, they couldn't be more careful.
Maybe what you should do is use someone else's hands.
So what else you got? You got anything? I got something.
Yeah.
Somebody tweeted about this, and I thought it was really cool. A Chinese county has rescinded. This is a real law. This was like something real. A Chinese county has recently rescinded a rule urging its government workers to smoke more in order to boost tax income. Did you hear what that said?
Say this again.
A Chinese county has recently rescinded a rule urging its government workers to smoke more in order to boost tax income.
So, why would they rescind something so silly like
that? They increased taxes on cigarettes, and then they made everyone buy more cigarettes and smoke more. They've recently rescinded this rule. How good of them.
You know what's so funny about that? Weren't we talking about this before, about the morality of throwing taxes and assigning programs and don't you find it funny that we were just talking about this, that we were we're assigning tax revenue to certain programs like, you know, child health care and all of that on smoking or other drugs, and now we've got China doing the same thing, but except for they realizing, you know, you can't make people smoke. It's not a good thing.
Yeah, that one just tickled me pink, you know.
But it sounds weird. You know, China's doing this thing, but we do the same thing. We're just not as forward about it.
That's right. Yeah. So what else you got?
Antonin Scalia.
You know, this wine. This what are we drinking?
Oh, it's not Antonin Scalia. We're not drinking Antonin Scalia. That's a totally different drink. This is Cycles Gladiator. We've done this before, but this is an 07.
It's percussive and athletic without any gaminess. I love this. It's
percussive?
Yes. I was reading in the Utney Reader, which is one of these sort of liberal, commie, left-wing, pinko rags that just republishes articles from other magazines that are interesting, you know?
Like the AP.
Well, no. They do a little more than that. But so there was an article in there, and it was labeled something like, "Are wine snobs worse than art snobs?" And I said, I got to read this. And this guy writes a wine column for normal people, but he was at a recent art show, and he was standing in front of a work, in front of a piece, and the people, these pretentious people were sitting around going, "Oh, lovey, it's very percussive."
Percussive.
Yeah. And then everybody else sat there, and he could see the look in their faces that, like, they wish they thought of that word. You know?
Ooh, good one.
It's perfect. So yeah, this wine is percussive and athletic without a hint of gaminess. It's wonderful.
It's a fabulous description, Wellington.
Yeah. I'm really bummed that there's chips in my glasses.
Well, it's better than chips in your teeth.
Yeah.
So anyways, I was mentioning Antonin Scalia. You know, some people don't like him, but I think he's pretty amusing. What do you think about Antonin?
He's a riot.
He's a laugh riot. He's a veritable laugh riot. No, here's the deal. Antonin Scalia, I love that. I've got a picture of him, by the way. Here's the article.
He looks like a Simpsons character, actually, kind of.
He does. You might not like his politics, but the guy speaks his mind, and he's pretty funny in an interview. He's scoffing at more calls for data privacy protection. So he goes and on these speaking tours, and he talks about, you know, data privacy, and he's saying that we don't need more data privacy. We don't need more data privacy. You know, it's overblown. So what ends up happening is there's at Fordham Law, the professor was teaching a course on privacy, and he gave them a project. And what they did is showing just the publicly available information. They put together a 15-page dossier on Scalia, and they presented it to him at this, which had information like pictures of his family, his wife's email address, phone number, address, and all this stuff. And he just flipped out. Like, how did you get this information? It's like, because there's not enough data privacy.
Right. Well,
I love
good.
I love it when you rub people's nose in the crap that they're spewing.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, that's a bit.
Want to play a tune?
Yeah, let's play it.
What do we got? We got something good first?
No, nothing good.
All right, let's check it out. Right.
Yeah.
That's pretty spoken stuff.
I like it a lot.
And it pains me to have to say this, but I don't know the band name because I lost the freaking email that one of our loyal listeners, Scott, had sent me. That's actually his cousin's band.
Good stuff, though.
And that one was called Only Nine.
Well, we'll post that online.
Yeah,
we'll find it.
You know, the next show that we do when we're together, when we actually know the name of the band, we'll mention it. But we'll fix that glitch, as John pointed out in one of our last shows, on the blog. So
we'll blogify it.
If you want to know the name of that band, when we release the show, it'll be on the blog.
There will be some serious blogification.
That's right. That's right. So we got crazy movies. We've been talking about current events. So, you know, I've got four things here that I can talk about really quickly, and you got like a couple, and
we got one
mutual one. Let me go first since I have more.
Yeah, hit me.
Let me do it in reverse order since I saw that. Say something while I reorganize my notes here.
Burble, beeble, bop, boop. You can edit this out.
Vogon poetry or something. Mm-hmm. I saw a film a month ago called Gomorrah. And it's sort of the tagline for this film was the movie about the mob, which is going to take the romance out of The Godfather. And I guess it's the film is kind of about the way the modern mob is working in Sicily and southern Italy and stuff like that right now. And it's an Italian film directed by Matteo Garrone, 2008 film, not rated, 137 minutes long.
What you think?
I really liked it. It was really, I thought it was really powerful and it was very graphic. I mean, when they showed the previews for this film, two of my friends didn't go to see this film because they were expecting to see violence. And And it was pretty violent, but in a way that didn't bother me. I mean, you know, the stories were compelling, but and in a way, this is a criticism of the film, but we didn't get to know any of the people well enough to care that they got offed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, in The Godfather, we really learned to like, you know, just like in A Clockwork Orange, we really learned to like Alex, even though he's a sinister son of a bitch, you know? And in The Godfather, we really learned to like Sonny Corleone and all that.
Well, even more, Michael Corleone. You got to like him as a guy who got reluctantly dragged into the family, and then he became the family. And yeah, I think those are the best characters, the ones that aren't just simply, you know, two-dimensional, but the ones that are good and bad all wrapped up in one. It's kind of like peanut butter cups.
This film is about the mob people that aren't living like... The Corleones had an empire, if you will. You know, all the families, the way they talked about them.
They had, you know, congressmen and senators like so many coins in their pockets.
And their income was huge. Their income was huge. You know, they were obviously bringing in millions, I would imagine. Millions and millions.
It wasn't all from olive oil.
And they were living well. This film is about the everyday guys. You know, they it's really tough eking out a living, you know, with their collection rackets. You
Pimping
know?
Ain't easy.
Dave Harry, man. He used to say that all the time.
I know.
And I had been meaning to bust that out, actually. You beat me to it. But yeah, these are the guys who have to scrimp and scrape as mobsters to make it, you know? And there are competing families. But, you know, these mobsters are just old and tired. And, you know, they're really having a difficult time making a living. And then, you know, a competing mob will come in and try to take their territory. And then there'll be a war of some kind. And, you know, just like at the end of
the mattresses.
Just like at the end of The Godfather, where they were going legitimate and they were going to take over the casinos and they wiped out, was it Mo Green?
Yeah.
You know, you have that kind of scene in this film, too. But again, you know, a much lower budget film than The Godfather, but in many ways a more realistic and gritty film. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Really good. Really good. I mean, again, I can usually tell how much I'm liking a film by if I look at my watch in the middle of a film. And this film was gripping. I mean, it was amazing. And as my friend, you know, my friends who didn't go to see it, I didn't find it quite as disturbing. They may have found it disturbing. I didn't. I mean, I know this kind of thing is happening in real life. And I would have been far more disturbed if I had really learned to care for one of these characters before they got a bullet in the temple. But that really hadn't happened. But anyway, you know, really powerful film, you know, great story and, you know, very, very real and very gritty and very earthy and very good. Anyway.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's cool. Well, kind of another gritty and real film that I saw, it was a documentary. It's called Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired. And this was a film about Roman Polanski, the director. He's done some films. One of my favorite films of all time.
Yes.
Chinatown.
You know what we do to nosy people.
Hey there, kitty cat. Where are you going? So this is about him. And unless you are living under a rock and don't know much about film or both, Roman Polanski is a director. He's Polish. He actually survived the Holocaust.
Polish Jew, actually.
Right. Yeah. Polish Jew.
And usually SKY as opposed to SKI. Usually the SKY is, isn't he Polanski with a Y at
it's
the
It's with
end?
An I.
Oh, that's interesting, because usually I. Polish Jews are SKY. Okay. Oh,
so he,
I stand corrected.
Yeah, his parents were killed in the Holocaust. He survived. And then he went to Europe and France and became a director, and also he was an actor. And then he became somewhat renowned. He made some films, had a great personality, and then he went to the United States. He did things like Rosemary's Baby. But what ended up happening was, if you don't remember this again, remember that guy? I can't remember if this made the news. I think his name was Charlie Manson. Yeah, Charlie Manson.
Yeah, Polanski was involved.
Charlie Manson and his family. What they did is one of the victims was his wife.
Wasn't that one of
Sharon
Tony's
Tate.
Favorite singers on his Facebook page today? Didn't he list Charlie Manson?
I don't know if that. But Sharon Tate was his wife. She was a model, and she was actually pregnant when she was killed.
Yes.
And this really devastated him. Not only did it devastate him, but this film shows, but the press accounts afterwards were almost, because they at that point they hadn't caught the Manson family, they were almost like accusing Polanski and their lifestyle, you know, being these people who had parties and stuff all the time at their house, as being the cause for this, you know? I mean, the guy just had his wife and unborn child murdered, and the press is really bashing him for almost being to blame.
Well, the press is always looking for pathetic stories. I mean, it's sad. You know, we're all going to die of swine flu too, right?
Right,
yeah,
of course.
Not.
Didn't we already die of swine flu?
I'm dead. Okay. I died of swine flu last week.
I think I died of swine flu, and I infected all of Europe.
You remember the first swine flu craze during the Carter administration? Do you remember that?
No.
I mean, this is not the first swine flu craze. Back in
that was a piglet flu.
Back in 77 or 78, when Jimmy Carter was in office, there was this talk of swine flu, you know, coming to America.
I thought
and
that
killing
was killer
everyone.
Bees.
Those two, but you know, they even had the movie. The Killer Bees movies came out in the late 70s. I went to the Uptown to see those, in fact. But yeah, swine flu was like this craze, and they had developed a vaccine for it. And my dad, up at Riverside Mall, went and got the vaccine.
Oh, did he?
And it was the first time I had seen those air guns that, you know, they shoot the vaccine into
like
you
Star
with
Trek.
Yeah. And that's the first thing I thought of. This is like Star Trek technology coming to life. Dad said it hurt just as much, if not more,
right.
as a real needle. But, you know, there's no need to have to use a new needle every time.
Right.
But it's an interesting technology that I'm sure they've improved by now. But nonetheless, this is not the first swine flu scare. And the first one amounted to a big nothing, too. As you and I were discussing, not that the flu can't become a pandemic like in 1919 or what it was, like 12 million people around the world died from a flu pandemic.
But not this one.
No, but it can happen. So, I mean, you know, certainly it's wise for, you know, organizations like the, what's that thing called? The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, to monitor these things, but the media doesn't need to jump on the we're all going to die. Suddenly they're Hudson from Aliens. We're all going to die, man. We're all going to die.
Well, back to Polanski anyways.
Polanski.
All right, so.
I thought you were done.
No.
I got more.
So Polanski, you know, you're done. Polanski, he's devastated. His wife was just murdered. So, but he continues on and he makes more films and he actually does some other side gigs, like he does some photo layouts for Vogue magazine, taking pictures of people. But he gets himself into some trouble. And this isn't like an accusal thing. This is actually, he's admitted it, and this is what happened. He started taking photographs of a 13-year-old girl, and then he ended up having sex with her, gave her...
Not good.
No, he admitted, gave her a quaalude, gave
in
her...
In many cultures, common.
Yeah.
Ours, no.
No. Gave her some champagne. They were in a hot tub together. And the funny thing, I mean, that's not funny.
Well, if you're in a hot tub, you got to have champagne, though. I mean, that's just a rule.
Yeah, it's not
champagne.
A funny thing, especially being the father of two girls. I shudder the thought of any of these things happening to my daughter. But if you're going to do this, the best place to do it is Jack Nicholson's house, because that's actually where it happened. And I was stunned, like this weird fact out of nowhere. He went to Jack Nicholson's house. The housekeeper let him in. And this all happened. Anyways, he's arrested for it. He's convicted. But here's where it all goes haywire.
You know? Oh, because the rest wasn't just weird and wrong and inappropriate.
Well, yeah, what he did was absolutely wrong, and he should have, you know, paid some sort of price for it.
I think it all started going haywire when his wife and child were murdered,
well,
actually.
Well, you gotta wonder how much that affected him and his relationships afterwards.
Yeah, his mental state, hello.
Yeah, but I'm not giving him a pass because of that. The deal is, what happened was the judge in the case got a little bit starstruck.
Lance Ito?
No, and it was the funny thing you say.
Lance Ito's father?
It's funny that you say that, because the judge was a lot like Lance Ito, where he was enamored with the press and he really wanted to hang out with celebrities and everything, and he wanted to make this big thing. He brought the press in to do press conferences and all this.
And he handed him a big manila envelope. I wrote this script.
Right. And he even was bringing in reporters to get their opinion on how he should pass judgment. And this is ridiculous, and it got way out of hand, and they really abused justice. I mean, they took a guy who should have been just normally punished, and they kept pulling these strings. They put him in 90-day evaluation, and then they pulled him out, and then they were saying that they're going to give him another sentence and all this stuff. So instead of going through all this turmoil, he decided to buy a one-way ticket to France, and then he never came back. Literally, he never came back. He's still there. He's still in France since the 70s. So, I mean, it's a fascinating film about how, you know, one person.
You sure it was a one-way ticket? Sometimes they do deals on round trips, and maybe he just didn't cash in the return ticket.
I don't know if literally it was a one-way ticket.
Oh, okay.
But by now, it's still a one-way ticket. I don't think
it seems to be a one-way ticket.
I don't think he can redeem that return trip.
You mean they didn't go to Sawatineo in Mexico?
No.
What film reference is that?
I have no idea.
Shawshank.
Was it?
Remember, they eventually went there.
I don't remember that.
Oh, God.
But I think that this is a film that people should see because this really shows you, you know, you could say on the surface, oh, yeah, guy molests a girl, he should go away, blah, 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 blah. But you really have to see all of the aspects
Charlie
of this
Chaplin,
story.
Hello.
You really got to see all the aspects of this story to see, you know, how this human being was, I think, abused in many ways by the press, by the legal system, and again, not dismissing his act, deplorable. But I think that, you know, we should all appreciate the shades of gray. So, good movie.
Saw a film, and this is one of the four I'll talk about briefly. This one was called The Class, directed by Laurent Conté, 2008 film France, from Francais, 128
Polanski.
Minutes, subtitled. Francais Polanski?
No, what? Did he do it? I mean, he's in France.
No, Laurent Conté did this.
Oh, okay.
And this is a film, think Dead Poets Society, but better and shot almost as in a documentary style, you know, handheld cameras. It's a story of a particular teacher with a particular multicultural class in Paris or France, somewhere in France anyway.
Oh, Captain.
And
Captain.
Yeah, Oh, Captain, My Captain. There wasn't a lot of that going on. But what I loved about the particularly the style and the way this film was shot was the classroom scenes were real. It seemed like if I had a little bit more progressive teachers, not unlike Robin Williams' character in
Dead Poets.
Dead Poets Society. Thank you. I could have seen these conversations happening in my high school class. I mean, you know, our most progressive teachers were usually the substitutes because they could take more risks because their job kind of wasn't on the line like the regular teachers.
Right. They could throw chairs across the table.
Well, we used to just do crazy stuff when substitutes were in. But I love the way this shot was, you know, was – I love the way this movie was shot because it was filmed – like the classroom scenes were like 20 minutes long and they were real interactions which in length were what would amount to half of a period, right? You know,
right.
Periods in school were 40 to 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And these scenes were like these real interactions between students and this particular teacher who was actually very cool and very progressive and very young and very hip. And he had this amazing multicultural class.
Was he hip and now?
He was now and wow.
And happening.
Yeah. And he had students from Asia. He had Asian students. He had African students. He had students, you know, Eastern European students in the class, some of whom were struggling with their French still. So all like the sort of trials and tribulations of being a teacher. He in his subject is French. He's teaching French.
Ah.
But the other dynamics of the film came about because he was on the teacher's – the disciplinary board. And, you know, some of the students would have problems. And what we ended up seeing was kind of the way nothing that I've ever seen in America happens. You know, you have a disciplinary board where students have representatives on the board. Teachers have representatives. It's like democracy. Hello.
Imagine you know, that.
Yeah. If you're going to be sentencing students to some sort of expulsion or worse, you know, or deportation ultimately, which was a potential for one of these African students, you know, it seems fair to have a student representative on the board. But anyway, love this film, almost like a documentary style Dead Poets Society, but I thought a little stronger.
It was a mockumentary.
No, not at all. But there is a documentary out now about a
rockumentary.
About a band called Anvil. Have you seen the commercials for this? And it's sort of like a real Spinal Tap. It's about a metal.
A real band?
It's about a real band that never quite made it. And it's about their documentary on like one of their comeback tours. And it's supposed to be amazing. So I definitely want to see that. But what do you got?
Well, I wanted to mention also that I made it through about halfway through Who Killed the Electric Car, something that
we
talked about before.
Yep.
It's funny because the half that I got through, and I didn't get through the half only because, you know, I didn't want to watch the rest. It's just a time constraint thing. And I wanted to mention that I started watching it, and it got to the point where they sort of made the case of what actually happened during the electric car production and distribution and then, you know, revocation of all the rights to these electric cars. And then it's going through and trying to actually assign blame. You know, it's going through that phase. I don't know if you remember the film where they say, okay.
I remember it well.
And then they distribute blame equally amongst all the different groups, like, you know, the car owners, there's no demand, you know, the manufacturers and all that stuff.
Well, I'm not sure that there was no demand. There certainly
Well, no.
Was...
That, I'm not saying that. They're just going through case by case as to, you know, who could have possibly been to blame.
Well, at the end of the day, I think the most compelling argument about who killed the electric car is the oil industry. I know the oil industry is often the bad guy and the patsy for a lot of things, but you know, the best example that somebody in the film gave was what geologists estimate to be the number of barrels of oil still left in the crust of the earth that we're going to be able to easily gain access to, and at the current price of oil, how much money that amounts to. And it's just trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars. So why is it that you think these guys don't want to make this money? You know, I mean, you, but I mean, why is it that anyone would think that, you know, big oil doesn't want to sell us this oil? As long as it's there, they're going to want to sell it to us. And
yeah, well, and I think that, you know, that's the bigger, you know, culprit in this, because they're the ones who've got the muscle behind.
And they have the power. They have money. They have power.
And then, you know, by association, you've got the automotive manufacturers
who are in bed with
big
oil.
They're beholden to them.
But it's
not just that they're in bed with them.
I see it as so dumb, because whether or not the cars are powered by an electric motor or an internal combustion motor, car companies still get to produce cars.
Well, and that was one of the arguments.
They still get to manufacture cars. There's no need for them to be in bed with big oil.
Well, that was one of the arguments that there's a one reporter, I can't remember which publication.
Baba Wawa?
I don't remember. But he was saying that he doesn't buy the argument that the manufacturers were
Maury
killing
Povich?
It. Because he was saying, oh, yeah, well, it doesn't matter if the cars ran on crap, they're going to sell them because they want to sell cars.
Yeah.
Well, I don't believe that because it costs more for them. The profit margin is decreased in the short term.
In the short term. But
right.
Once they pay off the tooling,
they're fine.
They're
not thinking about the long term. They're thinking about their profits
now.
Yeah,
and they're all going out of business because of it.
Exactly.
Hello?
So I don't buy the argument that they're thinking long term and we're going to put together a nice infrastructure for developing cars on multiple.
Whether they're thinking long term or short term, the fact remains that regardless of what is fueling as the energy source, they will still get to manufacture the car regardless of what's powering
it. And that's how they should be thinking. They should be thinking long term.
It's undeniable.
But I don't think that they are, and they have been. And as we can see, now they're going out of business, like you said. What they should have been doing all along is saying, okay, what are the energy sources that we're going to need to be building products for? But instead, they're looking at the short-term gains, and they don't want to put any money up front where there's some speculation possibly. And so what really, really – I mean, to cut this even more short, what really struck me about this was how so many people were using these products, and they literally got them ripped out of their hands. They took them back. People lined up and said, we want to pay for this. They were going to present the automotive. They were going to present
The Saturn. Saturn created a car called the EV1, which is what John is talking about. And all of them were not sold. They were leased to their customers.
Right. They were leased to the customers.
There was no buyout at the end of the lease, however.
Right. And when the lease ended, because they wanted to kill the program, they went and collected the cars, brought them back, crushed them, destroyed them, shredded them.
Well, one exists in that museum. Have you got to that scene yet?
No, not yet.
Oh, okay.
But what they did is a lot of these people, they loved the cars because they worked great for them.
Loved is an understatement for some of these people.
They had clubs, car clubs.
Yeah, these people really loved their cars.
They got together. They found the one repository of these vehicles that hadn't been destroyed yet. And they held vigil out there, and they were just there for days and days and days. And they got together a collection and said, look, we're going to present GM this check for, I think it was over $1 million, because we want to buy these cars back. And they turned it down, and they just destroyed the cars.
Yeah, and this is actually, this dovetails nicely with something I saw on Dave Letterman last week. That guy with that really weird name from Tesla Motors, he's a Silicon Valley.
Elon Musk.
Elon Musk, yeah.
He's the PayPal guy.
Yes, he came from PayPal, and he is now the CEO and a major investor in Tesla Motors, which, of course, is making the Tesla sports car.
Mm-hmm, the Roadster.
And they're releasing a Lexus Infiniti BMW-level sedan.
It's like a $50,000
car. Yeah, it's going to be a $40,000 to $50,000 car.
It's already released.
The sedan I didn't think was.
No, it's out. There are people driving them now. They're taking delivery already.
Well, that's interesting, because I thought he said it wasn't. But anyway, the Roadster is available, the sedan, and then in 2 years, they're talking about, you know, doing a Saturn-level family car in the $30,000 price range.
Still kind of high,
but there are people in Utica, New York buying $30,000 sedans. Well, there's people buying $50,000 sedans.
There are people in Utica, New York buying $125,000
cars. Well, I understand that, but you know, normal people aren't. But as the tooling comes down and the technology comes down, it's going to start paying for itself, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
We know how that works. But Letterman doesn't know a lot about the technology. And I like this new David Letterman. I mean, I wrote a thing like, when did David...
But Letterman knows about cars.
He does. He's a car guy, and he sponsors an Indy car racing team, in fact, Ray Hall Letterman Racing.
Yep. And, Worldwide Pants.
Yes. And he is a huge car guy. And, you know, Letterman, but he doesn't know a lot about the electric guitar either, but he doesn't know a lot about electric cars. And he said to Elon Musk, whatever happened to the electric car? And he countered immediately with, well, it's interesting you should say that because there was a film a few years ago called Who Killed the Electric Car? But Letterman, you know, I like this new Letterman. Again, ever since he had a child and ever since he had his heart bypass, his heart attack fixed, he's like a different person. And he said, you know what, Elon, he said, if these car companies didn't scuttle the EV1 program, we'd be on the EV4 by now, the fourth generation version of that car, and maybe GM wouldn't be begging for money, you know?
Exactly.
And Letterman comes out and says that, and Elon Musk didn't want to agree too vociferously because he could still be crushed. Their company is still pretty small.
Oh, sure.
But he was shaking his head and agreeing, but he didn't want to be the one to say it, you know what I mean? But Letterman is asking tough questions now, and I like it, you know, and I agree completely. We should be on our fifth, sixth, seventh generation of electric cars right now.
Well, even the EV1 was actually pretty cool and effective because I saw the way that the thing worked is, you know, you drove it into your driveway and there was this little thing, you plug it in. It was like an induction kind of charger and overnight charge, and you got over 100 miles, perfect for commuting.
And the new cars are, you know, with lithium-ion batteries and whatnot, they're 250-mile cars now, the Tesla and the Tesla sedan, and they get like an 80% charge just plugging it in for 20 minutes, which is incredible.
Right,
because
which
if
is
you're
amazing.
If you're at like a, you know, if you're on vacation, you're taking a trip and you're at a restaurant or a Wendy's, you know.
Stop, have dinner,
plug it in. And it doesn't take anything to add this infrastructure because the electrical infrastructure already exists. Everybody's talking about hydrogen cars. That would be an enormous infrastructure.
It's a red herring.
Well, I'm not sure it's a red herring, but it would be an enormous infrastructure to put into place now, you know, building a hydrogen gas station infrastructure. But all it would take for every truck stop and every Burger King and every restaurant in the world would
outlets.
Be a few $1,000 investment to add a few outlets and
right.
a metered outlet.
Metered outlets,
yeah, you pay $5, you get 20 minutes of charge, your car's at 80%. Done deal.
Yep.
It would be a minimal investment, and it's something that's there right now since we have an electrical grid.
Yeah, the reason why I say that hydrogen's a red herring is because they've done a lot of studies with this, and from what I've read and what I've heard is that, you know, the amount of energy that it would take to produce hydrogen, it's not like it's floating around out there. Sure,
it is floating around out there. It's ubiquitous.
It's a common thing.
It's like Helvetica.
It's a common thing, but it's bound up with other atoms right now into other molecules. So to produce pure hydrogen actually costs a lot of money. You have to generate that.
Whereas in space, we just have hydrogen floating around.
To collect enough of it that's useful is going to cost a lot of
money. That's why the Enterprise
money.
Has a hydrogen collector. Where have you been, yo?
Point is, the current technology, it costs a lot of money to generate hydrogen. You can't just, you know, generate hydrogen for free. Right now, like exactly like you said, we've already got the electrical infrastructure in place. And there are a lot of people who say, no, we can't do that because that's burning fossil fuels to create electricity.
I think the studies have shown, though, that there's a smaller carbon footprint if you're charging
Absolutely.
If you're charging electric cars.
And that's if we're just using just pure coal.
Actually, Elon Musk said that even if you're in a state that's 100% coal, and no such state exists, but if you're in a 100% coal state, you still have a smaller carbon footprint if you're charging electric car.
Yeah,
I'm going to take his word on that. Maybe I'll do the math and do the Google. Maybe I'll do the Google search. But
they said the same thing in the Who Killed the Electric Car. So I'm sure that someone is doing those studies. And you know what? I'm not like a lot of people. I think that we should probably be doing more research on nuclear energy because
I know you like the nukes. But
you know, if you can do it, if you can do it safely, I think you got a lot of energy out of that. And it's fairly clean.
Chernobyl, Three Mile Island.
If you do it safely,
did you not see the China syndrome?
Maybe if we put Jane Fonda in a reactor, we're all set.
I think we would be, actually.
Would she burn?
I hope she burns. No, I don't have a problem.
She's not a witch.
I like Hanoi Jane, actually. She's pretty cool.
Hanoi
you know, we
Jane.
Have more films to talk about, but we're running long here. So you want to get into another track?
I shall.
Let's check it out. We'll be right back.
dark at night, darker than I remember. Hope everything will be alright. What will I do this September without you here? I'd love to hear from you now, but your voice sounds like a razor.
Played them before.
We have never off this particular record, though. That was a band called Digger, and
this is their first record.
This is their first record. I didn't work on this one. This record's called Power Bait, and that one was called
September.
It's called September 1st, actually.
Is it?
And it's ironic that it's track 11 on the record because it's 11 September. It's track 11, which is called September.
Whoa,
there's some strange
dude.
Irony.
When
there.
Was that thing released?
Way before September 11th. Oh. Yeah, this record was made in, say something while I look up the copyright.
1991, 92, 93, 94, 95, 96.
Yeah.
That would come next.
Well before 9/11. But they wow. signed this one for me. Actually, it says, "Too rich, don't change your pants into shorts before it's warm enough." I used to wear those shants or slorts, you know, the pants.
Not
that,
a slanket.
They're like hiking pants that you can turn into shorts.
Wasn't a snuggie.
No, it wasn't a slanket. And then it says, "Too rich, a guy whose pants are shorts too." And then Chris Benner wrote, "Richie, keep on rocking."
Keep on wearing pants.
Yeah, these guys were a lot of fun. We played something from their second record, I think twice before. And,
yep.
They're a lot of fun, but I don't know. I think that's a show. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that we can burn it.
Yeah, rip it. Rip it up. Let's rip it off.
Like your pants.
Like my schlants.
Schlants?
Anyway, we haven't gotten any voicemail this week, but leave us some voicemail. 206-376-1907.
Wow. Send us email. feedback@bloodyveg.com.
Check us out on the web, www.bloodyveg.com.
Oh, and that is Rich Wilgus.
And I'm John Tallarico. Or no, that's John Tallarico.
Oh, yeah.
Or something like that. We have no guests today, but we survive.
Yeah, maybe we'll have a guest soon.
We should. We should bring in, like, somebody with a deep voice or something.
Grumbling.
A raspy deep voice.
Yeah.
With lots of reverb.
Right.
Anyway, you've been listening to VIB.